You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello, everyone. A quick message from Steve. This episode was recorded at Nexus. This is a live private recording that we did. This episode was originally supposed to go up on April 26th, but because of scheduling and other events that we had, it was better for us to release it on May 10th. So don't be confused by the date of this day in skepticism on this episode. This is a fun show. We really enjoyed doing these in-person episodes, and I hope you enjoy it.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Saturday, April 12th, 2014, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
And we have a special guest rogue this evening, George Hrob. George,
hi.
Welcome back to the Skeptic's
Guide.
Hey, George. Oh, so nice to be back.
Georgie.
Love having you here. So we are at Nexus. This is the second episode we're recording today, so that's why it's the same intro date as last week's episode. But this is a live private recording that we're doing. And George, you've sat in on some of these with us before.
Yes.
So we've had
I'd like to say something. You know, you're my favorite person that we interview.
Why must you fill this show with lies?
I just wanted you to know I love you, man.
So I think we have you on so often that we just sort of take for granted that all of our audience knows you, but just for anyone who might not. So George is a musician, a podcaster, a skeptic.
Right.
And you have the Geologic Podcast, which we all love, actually. It's awesome. If you're not listening to the Geologic Podcast, go listen to it. You are the MC of TAM. This is your third year coming up?
Fourth coming up, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Fourth. Wow.
Right? Is that right? Yeah, fourth
awesome.
MCing.
Yeah, great.
Where has the time gone?
I know.
Gosh.
So fast.
Yeah.
George, is your ask a question thing, is that effective, do you think? You know, it's a difference after?
I think it's effective, yeah. I mean, I had the song that I wrote, Make Sure Your Question is a Question, because we all know you go to the convention, you pay your money to go to the convention, and it comes to question and answer time, and there's a person on that you've paid to come see, and then some random guy stands up there and says, in my opinion, and they start spouting off for 6-7 minutes, and there's no question at the end of it, and you go, okay, what was the point? Like, hello? Could
and
there be a question?
And it's always nonsensical.
Nonsensical,
it's not like you're getting an insightful analysis. It's just some guy's personal rant.
Yeah.
Right? Soapbox.
Yeah. It's a soapbox. It's an opportunity to have a microphone in your hand. So I wrote this song saying, make sure your question's a question. You know, think less blog and more Twitter feed. That's the point of that song. And other people have actually wrote to me and that are running other conventions and things, or you know, sessions or whatever, and they play that song before the
that's
kind of cool.
They should fly you out just to do the song.
I would very willingly fly out.
Yeah.
Yes.
All right, so Rebecca, this show is going up on April 26th.
Yes, and on April 26th in 1986, one of the four reactors of Chernobyl experienced an explosion which became one of the world's worst nuclear disasters to date.
I understand it was very bad.
Yes. Although in the years since, there's been a bit of myth-busting concerning it. It's difficult to figure out how many deaths and illnesses to attribute to it because there's so many different causes for things like cancer and stuff. So it can be really difficult to really tell what the ultimate damage was.
Yeah, you have to calculate excess deaths.
Yeah.
You know, so you need some baseline. And
yeah, and it seems like that number has... Yeah. gone way down over the years as more and more research is done. But at the same time, as the years go on, they find new weird things like different plants growing in different ways and it's all...
The three-eyed fish,
Three-eyed fish.
Yum.
When Chernobyl happened, people were saying religiously, apocalyptically guided people were saying that Chernobyl meant wormwood, which is something that's mentioned in the Apocalypse, the Book of the Apocalypse, which is completely wrong. It doesn't mean wormwood at all.
What is it?
I mean, it's depending on how you translate it, but it means black pain, which is its own wonderfulness. Yeah.
Really?
But that kind of goes too, though.
You think somebody would have been like, maybe let's not name our nuclear reactor that.
Chernobyl is, Chorno is black and Bil is pain, so you could say that it means black pain, but it doesn't mean wormwood. So I always thought like okay, that's your proof that you know end times are here.
Not even a mistranslation.
It's not even close.
Right. Nostradamus.
And isn't absinthe made out of wormwood?
Yeah,
it's a fucking conspiracy, man.
There you go.
We just figured that shit out,
wow,
George.
Man. Wow.
You're on top.
Rebecca, what about the cause of Chernobyl? I've heard, I've never really investigated. These were the guys that were just like, hey, let's turn off these safety protocols and do this and see what happens type of thing. Right? Wasn't it? Didn't they just like, were totally messing around and.
I actually don't have a good answer to that. I'm sorry.
I didn't think it was them messing around. I think it was combined incompetence, yeah. Like multiple stages of combined
systemic
incompetence. And some faulty, like a faulty, like one faulty switch and then
and
tons
multiple
of,
layers of incompetence and a bad design in the first place. They didn't have the proper containment facilities, et cetera.
You know, and like a we'll wait till Monday.
Yeah, yeah.
Like literally, we'll wait till Monday
weekend,
and see what happens. Yeah.
It wasn't even announced until 2 days after.
Right.
Well, they didn't say anything until I think in Norway.
Until the cloud was spread.
Yeah, the
by
cloud
satellites.
Had spread up to up north, and they were like, why are these radiation like things spiking like crazy?
Hello.
And finally the Soviets were like, okay, small explosion. Whatever. You keep reading your thing, that's fine.
It's all a horror show.
Yeah. It's, yes. Nothing to see. It meltdown. What's meltdown? Your meltdown is my little poop. It's fine. It's fine.
And did you know that the last reactor wasn't shut down until the year 2000?
That's right.
Oh, is that right?
Mm-hmm. December 15th.
Whoa. What?
The year 2000.
Yeah. Oh, and then that same year, I'm Ukrainian by I was raised
by
Ukrainian,
trade.
So that year in the Svoboda, which is kind of the Ukrainian national paper here in the States, which my parents read, and it was always in the thing. Like, I thought it was going to be a good chance because there were these Ukrainian firefighters that literally gave their life. They died fighting putting out the fires to try to make some kind of a difference. So, of course, that year, the Ukrainians of the year were Jack Palance. Jack Palance, the host of Ripley's Believe It or Not. He was the Ukrainian of the year in 1986.
Oh my God.
And at the time I was, 13 or 14. And I'm like, that's bullshit. Like, shouldn't it be the firefighters that died?
Is that what Tiny George sounded like?
Exactly, yeah. No, you know what's funny? My voice has been like this since third grade.
Oh my God. I believe
it. I fell on a jungle gym and I hit my throat.
Really?
Yeah. And I think my teachers from kindergarten and stuff know me by my voice.
Yeah.
Because my mom still teaches at where I went to school. So I'll show up and they'll be like, oh, George is here. But this is what I sound. It was like,
you must
I think I need
such
a nap.
Such a ladies man.
It's just like, our cookies are coming, right? At some point there will be cookies will be available. And
I poopied myself?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. 2 and 2. I don't know what that is, but you know, math is not my strong suit.
Huh.
So why don't we go to Jay? Jay, you're going to tell us.
It's a hole. A man's right temple.
I'm good.
It's
more descriptions.
It's
please.
An inch big.
What is that? Is that Moluccan cup in ready at Yiddish or something?
What?
Yeah, that means I need you.
Really?
Like I need
a hole in the head.
Yes, right.
All right. So
yes.
What? This is a.
Where'd that come from?
I don't know. What is
speaking
happening?
Of holes in the head?
This is what we
call
Yiddish,
often do you have
Ukrainian.
A hole in
I don't. What is happening?
We call this news item the Black Sav Hubbub.
Hubbub.
All right, so a 55-year-old Australian man recently became the latest What's the Harm spokesman, unknowingly. He used something called Black Salve. I'm sure some of you guys have heard of it.
Salve.
Salve, whatever.
To
cure...
He used
salve.
You can use both.
Yeah,
salve,
yeah.
Both.
He used... Thank you.
Okay.
Salve, sometimes.
He used it to...
Salve. What?
By recommendation to cure what he thought was skin cancer. It was never even proven that it was skin cancer. So he applied the black salve for 4 months, and then finally,
4 months.
For 4 months. I have to bring up now, so you know where this is going. Of course, the black salve burned that hole in his head. But I was thinking like, okay, 2 days, say, before he went to the doctor, or even a week before he went to the doctor, after, 4 months of putting this shit on his head, he was cramming that black salve into the fucking hole in his head, right? Like, think about it. It wasn't like a little red, itchy spot before that happened. Like, he had to be putting that stuff on a necrotic hole for quite a while. Okay. Anyway, that just, tells you where this guy's at.
So let me explain something, though, that's not necessarily true, because you're assuming that it would have eaten through from the outside in, and it might seem like that's the most obvious thing, but sometimes, like, if you make the tissue necrotic, especially if the stuff is getting, like, soaked into the skin underneath, it could be eroding underneath.
And just going and going.
And then,
just collapse.
And then once the skin breaks through, it like immediately breaks through to an ulcer that's pretty all well
right,
developed.
All right, good. I was hoping I'm wrong. It just seemed like when they say he applied it for 4 months that this was like a regular thing. But all right. So anyway.
Apply to the forehead. Apply to the forehead. Apply to the forehead.
And repeat.
So he finally went to the doctor. they were really worried that, you know, first off, having like necrotic tissue on your head is bad. It's bad anywhere, but, you know, it's really close to your brain. It's like getting an abscess in your gums. Like, you know, it's dangerous because it's so close to your brain. But what they ended up doing was they sent him home. Like, they cleaned it out. I guess they cut away all the dead tissue and everything. And it healed up nicely after 3 months. Lucky for him. So now I'm online. I'm researching this news item, and I made the mistake of looking at the images when you type in black salve, and it's really, really disgusting. People with half their face eaten away, giant holes in their nose, and I'm, you know, this isn't like someone like cut it with a knife. This is like that guy's thing, like rotting, nasty, horrible stuff. Even in the description, when somebody describes what it does in a nice way, they talk about putting the salve on, it does its work, and like this big black nasty thing falls off of you. And it takes the cancer with it. Yeah, but it leaves this giant nasty hole behind. So everything about the black salve
is nasty.
And also
it doesn't take the cancer with it.
No, so here's
what it's...
Man,
have even had cancer to begin with.
Yeah, right. We don't even know if he had cancer, but this is not the way to deal with cancer, especially today. A little background on what black salve is. It's also known as drawing salve. It contains sanguinarin.
Sangria?
Nope.
Santa Maria?
Sanguinarin.
Sanguinarin.
That would be blood something.
Which is a derivative of black root. And they mix it with zinc chloride, among a lot of other nasty chemicals. Yeah. Of course, lots of people make black salve. They mix it with a lot of chemicals. There isn't any, like, one thing. But, you know, every single thing I read about it and every picture I saw about it was nasty. There isn't, like, a healthy version of this because at its absolute core, sanguinarin and the zinc chloride are nasty things that you don't want to be touching. They're acidic.
They're caustic. I mean,
they're caustic,
Their purpose is to burn flesh.
Exactly. Now, you know, you go back to the 1900s when this was created or the first person started manufacturing it, they would use it on conditions like mole scars, skin lesions, and sometimes cancer. And I, you know, you can think, okay, back in the day, there was really no treatment for cancer or things that they thought were dangerous or they didn't like or whatever. Yeah, I could see it then, but not today. Certainly not this year. Okay, so here's the other thing. The FDA listed this as a fake cancer treatment in 2004, and they're trying to ban it. And I wasn't really clear about what it means by trying to ban it because the FDA...
Because if it gets... It depends on how it's getting marketed. If they're careful not to make any disease claims about it, they can sort of market it as a supplement, in which case the FDA can't just automatically ban it. They have to prove
they're
that
using
it's causing
it as
harm. They either have to prove that it contains a drug or that they could ban disease claims. But if they want to ban a supplement, they have to meet a burden of proof to show that it's actually harmful. Just proving it doesn't work actually is not enough.
Right.
You actually have to prove that it's killing people or whatever. So far since, you know, in the last, whatever, almost 20 years, they've only succeeded in doing that with one thing, and that was ephedra.
Yep.
Because 100 people dropped dead, you know, of it. And that's what it took. And they're still being fought. They're still being appealed on that decision. But
and the FDA, you know, you get a countersuit, and you need that, like you need a hole in the head.
Yeah,
so,
right.
You know,
Too soon.
typically when I do research, I'll go to like known woo sites just to see what they say, especially for something like this.
Natural news.
So I go to natural news. It's clearly a very dangerous thing to do, and it's hurt a lot of people. So now here's what natural news has to say about it. What if we told you there exists a blend of herbs so powerful, effective, safe for treating cancer that no other conventional treatment even comes close? And what if we told you this same herbal formula only targets malignant cells while leaving healthy cells and other tissue alone?
Really?
The formula in question actually does exist, and it is traditionally known as Indian black salve, a magical cancer cure of sorts that also safely treats viruses and many other health conditions without causing harmful side effects. let me please read one more paragraph furthering the misinformation. If you have never heard of Indian black salve, it is probably because the U.S. Food and Drug Administration does not recognize it as an official cancer treatment. In fact, most medical authorities who have heard of Indian black salve reject it in any type of medical treatment because it is made from all natural herbs.
Right.
I like the part about it only attacking malignant cells. Like, if you consider your entire face malignant, then that is absolutely correct.
That is true.
Well, they must have been malignant, otherwise it wouldn't have burned it off, right?
QED?
I don't know about you guys. I'm sure other people feel exactly the way I do. But this garbage on natural news is just downright evil bullshit.
It is.
It's just, I mean, anyone that does any cursory research into black salve will see the damage that it does with hundreds of pictures online. I can't imagine that this was...
Yeah, but you see the philosophy, right? So, you know, they rail against modern cancer therapy is cut, burn, and poison, right? Chemotherapy, radiation therapy, and surgery. So that's their you know, anti-marketing campaign against it. But then black salve, it's, what is it doing? It's caustic. It's burning. You know, it's the same thing, but because it's natural and it's herbs, you know, whatever, it somehow is different. So they completely contradict their own propaganda. You know, they have conflicting propaganda. They have something that's natural, which is meaningless, but it's also caustic. So they just make up shit about it. Like, oh, it's only caustic to the cancer cells. Why? How did that possibly work? Yeah, it is magical.
So listen to this. There's one more sentence I want to read. And they asked the question in this article, how does Indian black salve work? The answer is, since mainstream medicine continues to deny the therapeutic value of Indian black salve, little is known about how it actually works.
Yeah.
Like, do you hate modern medicine, or are you, yes, you know, like that, whatever suits their needs, they pull in?
The answer is yes, he hates modern medicine. Yeah. He's a conspiracy
theorist. But he's saying, though, no one will know how it works unless modern medicine studies it and tells us how it works. So, you see the conundrum there, Steve?
Yes, I do.
Okay, thank you. So there you go. So don't touch this crap. It'll kill you.
Is there any comments after that? Like, oh, here's a link to a photo of a guy's head melting? Or is it all like, thanks for the info?
No, the first comment that I read here, some guy said, yeah, thanks for misrepresenting modern science.
Oh, good.
Yeah. And then some guy said, I got rid of melanoma with black salve and the zinc chloride.
I'm actually getting trolled on email by somebody from Natural News in the last couple of weeks. I made the mistake of corresponding with them because I wanted to see how crazy they were.
Do you like toast?
And crazy were they? They're all the way. I don't know how else to describe it. They're just as crazy as they get. I mean, it's a religion, you know, and once I try, you know, as I went through the process of trying to like establish some kind of basic common ground, but it's like they don't believe in evidence. They don't believe in science. Everything they disagree with is a conspiracy. I mean, it's just completely and utterly hopeless. And everything is, here's proof that you're wrong. And it's a link to a Natural News article.
Yeah.
Everything is, that's right, their proof.
I believe in cap locks.
Super caps.
Super caps.
Super caps.
So let's stick with the medical theme for another item. This should be fairly quick. So recently, the Australian government did an investigation into homeopathy. They basically did a systematic review of the literature looking at, this is really the clinical literature. They focused on studies looking at whether or not homeopathic preparations, I try not to call them remedies because they're not remedies, homeopathic potions, that's actually my preferred.
That's good. I'm going to use that.
Whether or not they are effective for any specific clinical indication. So they didn't actually go into all of the basic science or the history of it. It was just, all right, let's just look at the clinical evidence. Does it work or does it not work? They looked at hundreds and hundreds of studies, 57 systematic reviews involving 68 conditions. For 7 of those, they said that there's no quality studies. For 61 of them, they concluded that there was actual, like, evidence of lack of efficacy, that the clinical research showed that homeopathy doesn't work. Although they did say that most of the research is crap. That's basically what they said. Most of the research is of really poor quality. But what high quality studies there are all negative. Which is the same exact conclusion that the UK government came to when they did a systematic review. They actually did a more thorough systematic review. They looked at everything, not just the clinical evidence. And they concluded that homeopathy doesn't work for anything, that it can't possibly work, that it's essentially witchcraft. They actually used the word witchcraft in their official report. That the
UK or Australia, which one are you talking about now?
This is the UK now. UK. This is the evidence check to homeopathy. This is a couple of years ago. That we shouldn't pay for homeopathy and we shouldn't invest another dime in homeopathic research. It was a perfect conclusion based upon the evidence. The Swiss around that time came to the same conclusion and they said we shouldn't be funding this, but there's a lot of homeopaths in Switzerland. So you know what they did? They put together another committee packed with homeopaths.
See, now you think that they would have wanted a committee with just one homeopath and a lot of other people.
Yeah, right.
to make it stronger.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
All right. I love it.
That's why they failed because they packed it with homeopaths. They rigged up the review and they did it, reviewed the same evidence and they concluded, which is interesting if you, and so they made some seemingly supportive conclusions about homeopathy. So, of course, like Dana Ullman. You guys don't know who Dana Ullman is? Mm-hmm. Like, he's basically the internet troll for homeopathy. That's Dana Ullman. And he blogs at The Huffington Post, right?
The Huffpo.
So anyway, so the homeopaths were all crowing about the Swiss report. It's like, okay, let me take a look at this. So first of all, it's packed with homeopaths, so it's utterly worthless. But when you actually look at the conclusions, they actually concluded that the evidence doesn't show that homeopathy works. They couldn't even
fake
They couldn't even fake a systematic review. So what they did is, so they said, okay, well, the actual efficacy trials show that homeopathic treatments do not work, but we're going to look at the uncontrolled research because those are real world pragmatic studies and they show that people are happy and satisfied with homeopathy. So that's what we're going to go with. We're going to go with the uncontrolled stuff. That's what they actually concluded. But then the homeopaths saying they concluded that it worked. No, they didn't. They couldn't conclude that it worked because the evidence doesn't show that it works. So now we got the third big government review, the Australian review, showing it doesn't work. Mm. I mean, we have, you know, we're at the point where even if you just put evidence-based blinders on and looked at the clinical evidence, homeopathy doesn't work for anything. And it's been studied in here, 68 different indications. It simply doesn't work. But, you know, this is even putting aside the fact that you would have to violate the laws of physics and chemistry and physiology and pretty much everything in order to argue that it does work. And of course, I know everyone, you know, in our audience knows what homeopathy is, but it's still, you know, you have to realize most people don't know what homeopathy is.
They think it's medicine. They think it's a legitimate form of medicine.
Or herbal.
Just natural.
Natural medicine.
Yeah. Homeopathic means natural, yeah.
And when you explain to them what it is, their reaction almost universally
is, that's crazy.
No, that's not what
that can't be.
It can't be that.
That can't be.
Because that's crazy.
Because I can't have been deceived all this time. No, not
diluted
me.
And deluded sound similar
diluted
for a reason.
Diluted and deluded, yeah.
Steve, are you more hopeful now with entire governments concluding that, hey, and telling everybody that this is all bullshit?
I think
that in five years, 10 years, it really could be a worldwide crackdown?
We're actually...
Executions, maybe?
Yeah.
Hey, I mean...
Oh, great. I can't wait to see that show up on Natural News.
Right? The short answer is yes. I'm hopeful that we are going to marginalize homeopathy. Right. They never
go
away.
Which is the best we could hope for. Yeah.
Well, and also I think that this will substantially reduce the amount of funding
that
it gets.
That's a very concrete thing. Public opinion, you're never going to go away.
Yeah.
But we could get the NHS to stop funding it and close their two homeopathic hospitals.
Hospitals.
You know, that would be a concrete goal. I'd love to reverse
hospitals?
Not
homeopathic rooms, but entire hospitals.
Entire hospitals dedicated to homeopathy,
It's just empty rooms, though. Yeah.
But it's great. The medicine comes right out the taps. So.
Right. Yeah.
That video that, what are those guys, Weber and what?
They have 400
Mitchell
beds.
And Webb.
400 that's, beds, that's, one patient.
Yeah.
That's pretty damn accurate.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that in the U.S., the big problem is that there's like a 1947 law. When the FDA was updated in the 40s. Royal Copeland was a senator from New York State, and he was a homeopath. And he managed to, you know, he actually wrote the law and put in there, oh, yeah, and all homeopathic remedies are pre-approved.
I'm king.
Yeah. And we can, you know, and we can just add stuff to the list whenever we want. And so that's the law. Literally, they could make up a new potion, write it in their book, and it's pre-approved by the FDA. You know, that's the way it is. So that law needs to go away.
Yep.
I mean, that's a very concrete goal. And I just think we need to get, you know, the political will. We need to explain to enough people what it actually is and how egregious this is.
Yeah.
And maybe, who knows? Maybe we'll see some actual advances in that area.
I think it's highly effective to show people how to make a homeopathic remedy. Then the light bulbs go on. Like, what? That is what it is? Like, you need to see the process to see how ridiculous it is.
I have to say, this story. So when you do that, that's actually, as ridiculous as it is, okay, you take the dilution, you dilute it, you shake it 10 times, and then you do the dilution again. That's ridiculous. But then you have Boron, which is a multi-million dollar company, you know, mass producing homeopathic remedies. They're not even doing that. Do you know what they're doing? They invented their own dilution where they fill the vial, you know, they have the vial with however many cc's it has in. They put the substance from the previous vial in there, and then they entirely dump it out. They don't even keep the little bit remaining. So they're literally complete. And then they put the new solute in.
That's how my dad feels about vermouth and martinis.
Yeah.
You pour it in the glass, throw it away, fill it up with gin.
Yeah. Right. So, and why? So that it's actually its own kind of dilution. you completely empty the vial.
Yeah,
and just
it's not even
it.
Following the standard.
Yeah, yeah, and they're doing that because it's just easier to have the machines completely dump it out, and you know.
Because honestly, someone on the floor goes, "Look, this is bullshit. We're just what's the easier manufacturing
right,
process?"
Right, exactly. That's why I have to think. I mean, there's somebody who's so cynical to say, like, "Yeah, who cares? The rubes will buy it, you know. So let's just dump the whole thing out. You know, it's kind of a pain to have to keep the 1/100th. You know,
bit. Well, how did you find this out? They can't be advertising.
They
that.
Do. You have to because you know why? Because
that's stupid.
If, you know how you read like a homeopathic potion, it says like 10x is a 1-10 dilution and 10c is a, you know, is a 1-100 solution. Yeah. But they have, it's like a C with an asterisk, you know, and you have to, what does the asterisk mean? It, and it just has to say what it means, you know, you completely dump out the thing and refill it.
It says 10FU.
Yeah. 10BS.
10BS.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
All right. So, Bob, I think this is a pretty exciting news item. This is like one of those where if this were a science or fiction, I probably wouldn't believe it. Tell me about four quark matter.
Yeah, this one really got me excited.
You're shifting your chair there.
The Large Hadron Collider is in the news again. And I know they recently came back online, but also they announced this discovery of a potentially, I mean, it's not certain yet, but potentially a new form of matter. It's called a tetraquark, which is it's a bound state of four quarks, which is not really been shown to exist. So, how many people here love quarks? Right? Aren't quarks amazing?
I like quarks bar.
They're tasty and colorful.
Right. But they're so cool because half a cent. What are you laughing at?
How many people here like quarks?
Did you see how many people raise their hands?
They love it.
I was
they
excited.
Love
I was
it.
Excited.
It. Would you be should, here without it?
We should sell them, I think. There should be some kind of like quark bar.
The quark
something.
Market.
Quark
but
market.
Quark quarks board. Really, they really came to the rescue decades ago when
Bitcoin.
Physicists kind of thought, all right, we know what's going on. You've got protons and neutrons. That's good. And then they discovered all these other exotic particles and they didn't know how to really account for them. And quarks came to the rescue. The neutrons and protons were, you know, they had more fundamental components and these were the quarks. And as you say, a lot of you guys have heard of them. And they are pretty amazing. They've got fractional charge and then got this really weird color charge, which interacts with the strong force. It's really an amazing fundamental particle. I think it's fundamental, but there might be little strings in there maybe. Mm. So
or loops.
Wait, Bob. So to clarify exactly what a quark is, like, just give me a.
Well, that's what I kind of did, Jay.
So, like, they're like a proton.
They're fundamental particles.
But what's it look like?
Yeah.
Like a proton might be. I don't remember exactly. Like two up and one down quark make a proton, and something like that. And so you have like two. And the charges all add up so that you have one charge for a proton and a negative charge
for
an electron.
But it is the proton.
It is, yeah.
Right.
And the thing that's really cool, let me tell you about
not
quarks.
Entirely.
So you have three quarks. They're really strongly bound together. If you put enough energy in to pry a quark away from the other two, that energy turns into another quark, and you still get three quarks.
Right. So if you try to pull them apart, the force gets stronger and stronger, and eventually you're putting in so much energy to pull them apart, it creates a new
quark.
It's like stretching a rubber band.
I just
and then
said that. Yeah.
Instead of I got a better analogy though.
Are they massless?
Quarks massless? No.
No. Okay.
I don't think so. They
it's not denominational.
Back to the science people. So until 2003, scientists pretty much said they've only ever observed two different types of particles made of these quarks. You had the neutrons and protons, which had three quarks, and you had things like pions, which had two quarks, a quark and an antiquark. So that's it. And then in 2003, they got these hints of potentially, you know, these particles that were bound states of four quarks, these tetraquarks. But they never really could prove it because you never really know. Instead of having four quarks bound together, it could be two quarks that are bound, like two mesons that are kind of bound together. So it could be that, which isn't really a true tetraquark. So then in 2008, the Bell detector in Japan said, whoa, I think we really found this tetraquark. The evidence is looking really good. And of course, they gave it this super boring name. It was like Z4430. It's like, why the hell would you name a particle Z4430?
Why not Bobby? Or
No, I came up with one. Tetron. Tetron.
Yeah,
right?
Cool.
Isn't that cool?
Isn't that not,
I think
that's,
that
not
I think
a
that's
thing?
That's patented. Already?
How about Tetris?
No, it's that taken, I think.
Bob, they didn't find one. They were able to detect it, right? It's not like, are they rare?
I mean,
like, are they everywhere? Or
that's
what?
Just another way of saying
no,
find.
No, they're not.
No, because I want to clarify if they're rare or is this something that's they're everywhere. We just couldn't see them before.
This is incredibly rare. You've got to smash particles together.
They created one.
It's kind of like the debris from in a bubble chamber from colliding particles.
They found it in the debris of smashing crap together.
Right.
There you go.
And they don't exist very long. You're not going to be making.
Actually, they'll push out the fourth one and it's a temporary state.
No. They're unstable. They will not. Not like you're gonna have a tetraquark chair to sit in. It's not something that lasts long, right? It's unstable.
Yeah, but Steve said if you pull one out, another one gets created. So if they kick the other one out, does it create another?
No, you can't really kick it out. I mean, unless you start talking about a quark gluon plasma where you put so much energy that they're free.
Yeah.
Which is like in the beginning of the universe, it was this state where it was free flowing quarks because it was so incredibly hot and.
So it's a phenomenally natural state for three quarks to be together.
Well, of course, right? Neutrons and protons are kind of everywhere. But then what happened in 2008, the Bell detector found what they think is a tetraquark. Then just most recently, the LHCb, which is an experiment at the Large Hadron Collider. This is what this news item is about. They have really solid detection of this. They did like crazy stuff. They looked at 180 trillion collisions. They actually vetted 180 trillion collisions. Well, what they actually grabbed like 25,000 decays from the 180 trillion, and that's what they've been looking at. And the important thing about this, though, is that one experiment showing a tetraquark is okay, but scientists don't really take it seriously. You really need two. You need two independent labs to discover something before they're like, yeah, this is something. And that's why for the Higgs, you have the CMS experiments and the ATLAS experiments. That's why they put two different experimental setups at the LHC so that they could say two different independent experiments found the Higgs. And that's why everyone was so convinced. So that's why this LHCb tetraquark thing is kind of big, because they're kind of replicating what this Bell detector found. So that's why people are now like,
Bob, is there anything that knowledge of this tetraquark does, like, does it have a paradigm shift in our understanding of things?
Yeah, because up until now, we've only considered or thought that there was only these, you know, three and two bound states of quarks. If there's more, if there can be four, then there might be this big symmetry of particles that can exist with these quarks. That's possible. Instead of just one or two, you know, it could be something even more grand than what we experience. Plus, the implications of this could be that the interiors of neutron stars, say, we think they could potentially exist inside of neutron stars. So you might have tetraquarks, pentaquarks, hexaquarks inside of neutron stars. Mm. And this information could also make us confident that quarks can actually interact individually, which would give more evidence to things like a quark star and stuff. So this could really expand the possibilities of lots of different things that could happen with quarks and even neutron stars in the future. So yeah, this is cool. So keep an eye on it.
It must be super expensive to do these experiments, because imagine how high your insurance rate is after 180 billion collisions.
Yeah.
Trillion. Whatever, fine. Kill the joke. That's fine.
Trillion.
Actually. A jillion.
Thank you.
Get the science right if you're going to joke about it.
Gazillion.
Let's be honest, that joke was on its deathbed already.
Here's some black sap for it.
So, George, I'm very interested in the musical quality of instruments.
Mm.
We've talked about this on the show before.
Yes.
But I understand you're a musician.
Of some note.
Depends who you ask, but
of some note. Of some treble clef. Yes. So, you have an opinion about musical quality of instruments?
Oh, well, I have a personal opinion, absolutely, and there's a story that relates to my opinion, or my opinion being confirmed on some level. There is a, within the market of selling instruments to mostly semi-professional and non-professional musicians, there is this idea, of course, as with most things, that the more expensive something is, the better it is. And from my experience, it's just not true. I know I play drums for a living. That's kind of what I do as my day job, quote unquote. And, you can spend, you know, on a snare drum, you can spend $75 or you could spend $3,000. And I've never come across an instrument that was worth the difference in that
yeah.
amount.
On a recent show of yours, you talked about the drum set that you really want. What kind of drums are those?
Yeah, DW, Drum Workshop. Yeah, one, blue, right? Yeah, it's a blue sparkly drum set because blue sparkles are awesome. Yeah.
You like Mr. Sparkle?
Mr. Sparkle. Yeah.
I was just setting him up for
cut
that
out. Yes.
Washoo!
That too.
That didn't make any sense at all.
But recently, sort of, you know, this was, I don't want to say confirmed, but there was a study that was done. If you had to think of the ultimate brand, let's say, of instrument of any kind, like what comes to mind in terms of like the best instrument? Stradivarius, yes. It's like the Stradivarius of violins. Yeah. Stradivarius is universally considered the ultimate instrument. This is, there were a number of these made in the 18th century. There's something about the construction of these violins. They don't know what it is necessarily. There's theories that it might have been because the wood that was being used was from some old growth trees, or that the fact that they were stored in water might have condensed them. There's some idea that the varnishes that were used had specific apothecary stuff in them that made them more resonant. Well, universally, it's accepted that a Stradivarius violin is the best violin. Well, there was a study done in 2010 where they grabbed five Stradivarius violins and five non-Stradivarius violins, but modern-made instruments made in the last 5-10 years of a high quality, expensive instruments, but nowhere near. You know,
how expensive?
Stradivarius go any, you know, millions of dollars. I think the most expensive Stradivarius, I think, is like a $7 million instrument, I think.
What about the high-end non-Strad?
A high-end non-Strad could be $10,000, $15,000, $20,000. So significant, but nowhere near, you know, a $2 to $3 to $5 to $7 million instrument. And they tested these with string players. This is back in 2010. And they found, no discernible difference in the sort of playability or quality of this particular test. They just repeated this test, recently. Which is, I think Steve even wrote about that originally, the original test. Well, they just repeated it because there were all sorts of complaints that came out, of course, about, oh, it wasn't done in a concert hall. There weren't enough instruments. The musicians didn't have enough time with the instruments. So they replicated this. They did it again. They got, 10 violinists. They each got to play 12, instruments. It was 6 new violins, 6 strads. They got 75 minutes with the instrument. Both
75 with one.
75 minutes with each, with each instrument. Wow. So they could spend time in a practice room and then spend time in a rehearsal hall. They wore, goggles that limited what they could see. So they couldn't see the coloring of the instrument. They even scented, they had like, you know, in essence, those little like trees, you know, sort of as necklaces to affect, you know, so they couldn't smell the oldness of the instrument. You couldn't smell that sort of, we all know the Strad smell. I mean, it's like, you know.
Yeah.
It's interesting, though, because it's an intimate experience.
Very much so, yeah. I mean, you are, you know, you, this thing is in your face under your chin. Yeah, so there's even, you know, some question whether or not there's a tactile difference.
I love the smell of Strad in the morning.
Totally. Yeah. Totally, yeah.
It smells like
symphony.
Symphony.
So they did this again, and turns out there's a 6-to-1. They asked them to rate these 12 violins best to worst. And, there's a 6-in-1 chance. The new violins were chosen 6 times more than the Stradivarius violin. So, and 7 out of 10 picked a non-Strad as their favorite instrument. A modern violin is their new instrument. Now, does this necessarily mean that the new instruments are better than the Stradivarius? It might. What I think it definitely confirms is that there is no discernible difference, because it could just be randomized. You know what I mean? Like the fact that they chose new instruments, there might be something else at work that might not necessarily be better. But what it does show is that the Strad in and of itself doesn't have some inherently super obvious quality. And this just goes to show, much like wine tasting, anything that deals with
speaker cables,
taste, objective quality, discernment is really out the window. So it kind of confirmed that, you know, you can have a great, once you get past the base mechanics of an instrument in terms of, okay, how close are the strings to the fretboard? Is it built well? Or like a guitar, let's say, you know, are the machined parts machined well? Cause if it's cheaper, it's going to affect the playing of it. Or are you using plastic on certain parts that should be brass or should be a certain kind of wood or whatever? Once you get past that, I think the difference between, like, you know, the $1,000 instrument and the $10,000 instrument are very, very minimal, let alone the $10,000 and the $7 million instrument. Much of it is technique, and any good musician that knows their instrument, you know, will sound like them regardless. Yeah. You know, if John Bonham were to play, you know, on any, he's dead now, so it'd be much more difficult. But
Jason Bonham.
Jason Bonham. Or, you know, again, any musician, Eric Clapton playing a $35 guitar, there will be Eric Clapton-ness, which will come through, you know, and conversely, if I were to buy a $10,000 Eric Clapton guitar, I could never sound like Eric. Like, the instrument won't do it. It's amazing sometimes when you are at a gig and someone sits down to play your gear who is better than you, and you want to eat your own face because you just feel, it's like,
they get a sound out of your shit.
Yeah, out of your shit that you just go like, how are you? Wow, that is really cool.
George, why did the Stradivarius instruments become so worshipped then? If it's really, was it just a high-end instrument? Yeah, was it good marketing?
It's marketing. At the time, he was very successful. When Stradivarius himself was making these things 250 years ago, he was very successful, and that kind of became the violin that you would get. And then the fact that there are, every Stradivarius is cataloged. I think there's,
and
like,
named, right?
Aren't they they're named. Oh, yeah. It's a very small number. Harry. You know, it becomes this idea. This is a limited resource, and they're just, and then the hype just builds and builds.
But there's no doubt that he built a finely crafted.
Oh, absolutely.
Right?
Yeah, so absolutely.
I think that he probably was one of the best craft, you know, luthiers of the time. Got a good reputation. Yeah. Got a good, you know, had
luthiers?
A good name brand. Yeah, luthier.
Luthier.
Yeah, you pulled that out, didn't you?
Yeah.
I like it.
You named like one of your role playing characters luthier.
I did, yeah.
That's okay.
Luthier
Vandross. I happen to know what the word means. Isn't it?
Okay. For me, it was always that character. I didn't know it was a
Lex
real...
Luthier.
So anyway, so sure, right? Yeah. But now with modern machining and mass production,
that's the thing. Now, like, you know, my bass that I kind of, whenever I have to play bass, I have this Fender copy that was built in Mexico, and it's a $300 bass.
They're good.
Mexican fantastic. Good, this $300 bass. Built on, you know, machines using modern technology that have managed to figure out how to mass produce these things really well. That bass would have cost, you know, 20 years ago would have been a $1,200, $1,500 bass in terms of the way it plays. It's actually something that the music industry has to sort of, or the music production industry has to fight with, because there's plenty of guys that are 40, 50, 60 that were buying instruments when they were expensive that, you know, you just see a $300 price tag. And you can't,
you can't believe that it can't be
any good until it gets in your hands. And you just go, okay, why is this mismarked? Like, what is this, you know, what's wrong with this? But it's the fact that just the technology has gotten to the point where you can get very precise machining properties on any kind of a thing that you're building. And
it's
great.
The fact is they solved the production problem.
It's just gotten incredibly better than it was, you know. Yeah. So a $300 guitar, a bass, you know, in 1980 was, you could see where the glue was sticking out, and it was just, you know, the action was horrible and it didn't sound great. But, but now it's incredible.
But the industry wants to preserve the old sensibilities about price. You know, they don't want.
I think it's a battle. Like, would you rather sell $1,300 basses or $3,000 basses, you know? Yeah. So it's like, who's the market? And I think they've realized that there are so many people that buy instruments. I mean, most of the people that buy instruments are not professional musicians, especially popular instruments like guitars, keyboards, drums, and basses, you know. People that are buying saxophones and trumpets are going to be slightly, you know, apart from high school bands, you know.
But there is clarification, though, because, you know, 20 years ago, when you were starting, you know, in a band, and, you know, I was in a band too, like, there was a lot to be said about the electronics, say, that came with a Les Paul, right? There was something about the, like, for an electric guitar, like, they had a sound. The electronics that were there, the way that humbucker pickups, hold on a second, humbucker pickups have a particular sound, timbre, resonance, whatever, that you couldn't, other people could not knock it off. Today, they can knock it off.
Yeah.
And that's a big difference from the electronic standpoint.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right?
The reproduction of vintage sounds, vintage timbre, it's actually frightening how good it's getting. There are still some things that if you have a trained ear, you can kind of hear it and be like, okay, that's probably a fake. Like, there are certain drum sounds that if I'm watching a movie or a TV commercial, I can hear it and identify it as being, you know, the Star Trek sound.
Sure.
On a fucking phone.
Yeah, yeah.
No. I hear that and I say, oh, that's a Roland, you know, that's a Roland V drum, that snare drum. I know that snare drum sound because that's, you know,
yep.
But that's my thing.
No, but that's,
yeah,
that's part of the industry. We have, there's like the iconic sounds or whatever, and you could freaking mimic, you know, 10 name brand guitar sounds in a little pedal today.
Yeah. Yeah. That, I mean, they've always claimed that. I mean, you could have bought a pedal in 1980 or 1985 that said, sounds just like a, eh. And for like the first 3 seconds, you'd go, this is great. And then you'd realize, okay, not, this doesn't actually really sound like that. The keyboards, organ sounds. I mean, organs are notoriously difficult to reproduce. So actual B3 Hammond organ sound.
Yeah.
It's very, very difficult. And yet now, you know, for $60, you download this thing and you just, I mean, the keyboard player in the funk band that I work with, who still has, he has a B3 that he literally sawed in half so he wouldn't have to carry the bottom portion of it.
Yeah.
Cause these are these behemoths. So these huge 500
pound instruments.
Spinning
speaker.
Now that's, he simulates that.
Yeah.
You know, that's all done in a little amp thing. It's incredible how good and accurate it is with the digital stuff.
So something that musicians communicate to each other a lot is like the action or the playability.
Yeah.
How's it feel? And there's a lot to that feel. It's, you know, how hard do you have to press to make contact with the fret, like on a fretted instrument, as an example. You know, and even sliding your finger up, you could feel a difference in the frets in the fretboard.
Sure.
There's a tactile thing that is completely legitimate and very much tied to the sound. Right?
Yeah.
Like that fretboard and the metal and the frets themselves and everything, like that's all part of it. But today, I mean, I bought, like George just said, I bought a $300 Yamaha Dreadnought, 6-string acoustic guitar.
Yeah.
It played like butter. You play it and you're just like, oh my God, effortless, right? My $300 freaking, Yamaha, I'm like, this is Joe's Taylor guitar. Like they actually kicked ass. Like it's so good, it's ridiculous.
Yeah. Well, the one I had was like a solid top rosewood $300 guitar, and it was like, it plays beautifully.
Yeah.
There is a thing though, like when people start playing guitar, if they ask like, what should I buy? What should I start? And I often say like, buy the cheapest guitar you can, because in a weird way, you fight it, you know, like the first guitar I had, you know, the action, the strings and the fret were like, you know, an inch away. It was like, you had to use both hands to try to like form chords. And
not ever play anything with a B.
F, you were just screwed. Yeah. But, you know, it was good because your hand turns green for the first 6 weeks you're playing and you're just trying to play and play. And then when you do spend a little bit more eventually and get a better instrument, it's like, you know, it's like putting the donuts on the bat as you're warming up. You know, you get this like awful instrument that you have to fight with and try to get some kind of a sound out of it. You know, drums too. It's like you just hit, get the best tone you can out of the shittiest instrument you can, so that when you do get a slightly better instrument, then your technique will be what's producing the tone. So, but now like those cheap instruments are, I mean, it's either something you buy in the toy aisle, literally, or something that's $300 that's as good as a $3,000 guitar from 1985.
Yeah. So part of it is definitely the advance of the technology.
Yeah.
But I wonder, like, Jay, you brought up electronics. Like, I had the same experience with electronics, even like with medical equipment, is that you definitely get what you pay for. And like, we would buy pieces of equipment based pretty much on their electronics. And we would buy the machine with the best electronics, and you absolutely made a huge difference. But now it's like you can't find a machine with bad electronics.
Right.
They're all awesome. Yeah, they're all way better than what they need to be to do what we
need. Price point comes down, affordable, better.
Yeah.
But
that's it.
But I want the study I'd like to see done as a follow up to this, because you were comparing high end violins to Stradivariuses.
Right.
I'd like to see the full range and find out where is the
sweet
peak.
Spot. Yeah.
Where's the peak?
Yeah.
So you could do like a bang for the buck kind of analysis, but also like, where does it top out? Does it top out at $1,000, at $5,000, at $10,000?
Yeah.
And is the pricing honest? Are you really getting what you paid for? And where does that cease to be the case? And when are you just buying a brand label versus quality? And maybe that has come down so far because of modern machinery and production.
Because as of right now, we've really only helped millionaire violin players.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, both of them.
Yeah, but there's a thing too, like, Steve, keep this in mind. Back in the old days, you'd have to play a couple of dozen guitars to find the one that has a, you know, that is good, right?
Yeah.
And that was legitimate. But today, I ordered my Yamaha on Amazon. Like, it
came
in a cardboard box. I opened it up and I played it and the thing was in tune
awesome.
And it played.
Yeah.
Right, so that even that's different now.
Yeah,
they want to redo this the Stradivarius study again and include like professional or the equivalent of professional listener.
Yeah.
So people that are fans of music, put them in a concert hall and then have them vote as well.
That would
see
be
if
nice.
There's any difference. Ooh, that's the next step they want to do because the backlash is
keep doing it.
The backlash is huge. They keep saying like, cause first off, every violinist that has spent, you know, that, I mean, I know string players that have mortgages on their violins.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, they're newer players. It's, yeah, it's, I remember holding this like $75,000 instrument, you know, once, you know, and I said, how do you afford this? Mm-hmm. And, it, you know, she said, I have a mortgage on my violin. My girlfriend works for the Boston Early Music Festival, which might be hard to believe, but I do have a girlfriend.
This one?
I have seen her.
No, she works for BEMF, which is like the preeminent, classical music organization out of Boston. And last year, there was a tour that from Salzburg of Mozart's instruments.
Awesome.
So Mozart's violin, his viola, and I think his clavier. Like, it's the first time it's left.
He wrote a lot of
this is what he wrote stuff on. You know, it's the first time it left. It's left Vienna.
Talk about
agency. Never left. Yeah.
Oh, God.
And like, so part of me was so excited, you know, that like, here's the thing. I felt the same way I felt that when I saw Darwin's magnifying glass.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, at the Museum of Natural History, they had that great exhibit that you walk up to this thing and there's Darwin's magnifying glass, you know, and the fanboy part of me is like, you know, this is like Kirk's phaser. This is the coolest thing ever. Like, oh my God. But then the sort of rational skeptical part of me is like, it's just a,
nah, go with the good.
No, I know, I know, I know, I know, but it's this weird, like, why do I get that excited? Over, I mean, there's no, you know, there's no, at this point, there's none of Mozart's molecules are on this thing even, or any kind of.
On there, you never know.
Maybe a couple atoms, I
guess.
A little
dandruff guy.
Some quadra quarks, whatever those things are.
But it was that.
Petraquarks.
Petaquarks.
Petaquarks.
Well, wait a second, though. I understand, right? The agency is a concoction of our mind.
Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah.
But the idea that was the thing that he had in his lap, right? Like, he did come in physical contact with it. You know, like, imagine you see the guitar that, you know, Stairway to Heaven was noodled on in the beginning.
Right.
Just to be, like, there is something about, I mean, it is the instrument. It was there. It was in the room when
it
happened.
But what is the actual connection?
Purely emotional.
But it's purely emotional.
Right, right. But it is a real physical object that was there during an event that has meaning to
you. But it's representational. There's no agency.
You
there's
can't do
no
a test on it to tell
yeah.
you.
Yeah.
Wait, well, all right. But let me take it a step further. Like, as
what
an example,
if you put it in a teleporter?
No. No, but like imagine when you see the person's particular thing, like the magnifying glass, there was like a wear on it that he wore into it, that type of thing. Or like a lot of guitars get worn in and scratched because of belt buckles and whatnot and all that. And that's personal.
I stood outside of Abbey Road studio and just cried.
Yeah.
Because I was like there.
He has a girlfriend.
Did you walk across the street, the crosswalk?
I couldn't walk across the street. I couldn't go in. I was with a friend of mine. He was like, let's go in. I'm like, no, I can't. Because this was like Mecca. You know, this is like, or Mecca, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you. Okay, good.
Nope.
Two points. Yeah, Beatles fans pray towards Mecca. So I understand that, but like, you know, it's a physical structure. It's wood.
Yeah.
You know, it's whatever. Like,
I get it.
Why does that drive us so much?
And that's why eBay exists, right?
I guess,
So you should read Bruce Hood's book, Super Sense.
Okay.
If you want to know the answer to that, but let me give you my quickie summary of one thing that sheds light on that.
Yeah.
If you take little kids, like 2-year-old kids, or like somebody like Dylan's age, Jay's son's age, and they have a favorite toy, and then you do a magic trick where you take their toy, you put it in a briefcase, and then you pretend like you're creating an exact duplicate of the toy.
Oh, right.
So for regular toys, kids will happily accept the exact duplicate. But for their favorite toy, they will not accept the exact duplicate. Mm. There's something about the essence of the original toy that they attach to, even at that young age. So we have this built-in sense of essence, you know, that makes us, you know, imbue something with its uniqueness, even if it's not physical.
What's the usefulness of that? Why do
a good question. I mean, so now we have to weave evolutionary psychology tales about, you know, mothers want to know, like, the baby's their actual baby and not just a baby that looks their baby.
Yeah.
Maybe that's it. I don't know.
Yeah.
But whatever, it works for us. So that's part of the human condition. And my approach is always, you know, to understand that's the human condition, understand that it's evolved, emotional, irrational, whatever, but but it's okay to still embrace it. It's like
sure.
It's like anything that we really enjoy or get into is just happening in your mind because of the way we evolve. But so what? You know, it's as long as you understand what its nature is, you could still partake in it and enjoy it.
I had an idea that there should be like a skeptical real estate agency that's like sells houses that had murders occur in them.
Yeah.
You know, like it's super cheap, you know, it's a
great idea
house.
For a business that will fail immediately.
No,
there's a market for that. My sister-in-law just purchased a house. There was a murder in the house. They had to drop the, it was like a $2 million house. They dropped the price to like less than $1 million because it couldn't sell.
Psychological damage.
When you say there's a market for it, though,
there's a market
you're literally saying they dropped the price way down. That's not a market. That's a bad market.
But like somehow finding those deals, like having some kind of skeptical, skeptics won't care that there was a triple homicide or whatever.
So you're just like a Craigslist for skeptics to buy psychologically
damaged property. Yeah.
Or possessed dolls or whatever.
Yeah, like I really need that hunting knife even though it was used to behead someone.
Right.
But it's really cheap. It's only
It's cheap.
It's only been used once.
But if you think about it, we assign emotional significance to everything. It's everything. Everything is a personal item of ours. Everything.
Not everything, but some
things. Most things. People, pets, you know, freaking all the stuff in your house.
I had a bunny blanket when I was a toddler and it got really ratty. It was like a bunny head with a blanket attached. It's terrifying in retrospect, but it was my absolute favorite thing. I took it everywhere and it got so ratty that my mom took it and she bought another one that was exactly like it and she gave it to me and that was evil bunny blanket.
Yeah.
Like evil.
Exact opposite.
Like I burst into tears and I wouldn't stop crying. She'd dig through the trash and get out old ratty bunny blanket.
Covered in trash.
I still have it. I still have good bunny blanket.
Yeah.
Evil bunny blanket.
Send me a picture. I want to see.
Steve, what do you own in your life? I'd be curious to hear, like, what item in your house that's yours? Like, that
do you like save ticket stubs or anything like that?
I do. I have.
No. I don't have like just purely sentimental stuff. But I enjoy. Like I have like a fossil collection and like I have a sextant, you know, I have like instruments.
Yeah.
I have absolutely no use for them, but I just like this is
the coolness
of
it.
This is a trilobite.
But you don't have
anything? This is something that was swimming around.
Okay, so that's rare. You know, I mean, that's, you know.
But do you have a personal item?
Not technically.
No personal item of meaning? Like what about your first stethoscope or something along those lines?
Your first
stethoscope. I would have mine.
It was a Fisher Price.
That was the first and heart. That was it. I was the first patient.
I still use my first stethoscope.
Well, there you go.
Of course you do.
There you go.
He loves it.
Well, wait, literally, would you be upset if you lost it tomorrow?
Do you call it Steffi? And
Steffi.
Is there evil Steffi?
Is there evil Steffi? Yeah.
I have no emotional attachment to my Steffi.
That's interesting.
We'll find out. We'll get rid of it. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, right?
That's a good question. I mean, it's not like I'm against the idea. I just don't know that I have anything that I have purely sentimental attachment. So, Rebecca, I follow video game science very closely because I have a personal stake.
Yes,
I hear there's an interesting update.
There is an update to video game science. Yeah, this is something we've talked about in the past. You know, since the advent of video games, people have been concerned with what they are doing to our poor, misguided youth.
Yeah. But once the pinball machine was off the hook,
then we had to. Exactly. Once we smashed all the pinball machines with sledgehammers, we had to figure out this whole video game thing. So, psychologists study video games all the time, because, you know, it's the same, you know, we always wonder what all of the media we consume could do to us, like movies and TV, but video games are specifically interactive, and so they have the opportunity to affect us in interesting ways. So, over the years, we've had research that seems to show that video games do make us more violent, more aggressive. There was a study in the year 2000 in which researchers had people play violent or nonviolent video games, and they found that people who played the violent video games were more likely to punish an opponent for an extended period of time when given the chance. So stuff like that. But then there are complications. Like in 2010, there was another study that found that specific types of people were more likely to become aggressive after playing violent video games. So people who already had problems with rule breaking and interacting with people and things like that. So here's a new one to add to the complications. This research was just done University of Oxford and University of Rochester. Researchers from both those places teamed up. And they, similar sort of study, they had participants playing either violent games or nonviolent games. And they then tested them for aggression, both things like self-reporting, you know, how do you feel, but also having them take certain psychological tests that might indicate that they are suddenly feeling more aggressive. So what they found was that there was no difference between the people playing violent video games and the people playing nonviolent video games. However, there was one factor that did change whether or not people left feeling aggressive, and that was how crappy the game was. So for some of the subjects, they didn't allow them to practice the game before playing it, or they made the game exceedingly difficult, or they gave them counterintuitive controls that made it really hard to do anything. And so for those subjects, they came away feeling more aggressive and behaving more aggressively. So the takeaway is that maybe violent video games don't make us more violent, but crappy violent video games like Duke Nukem Forever or something might actually.
Castle
you disagree?
Castle Von Wolfenstein.
Did you play Duke Nukem Forever?
No, not Forever. I played the earlier
iteration. Oh, yeah, yeah. No, no, no. Forever.
It sucks.
I hacked the code. I upped the gore. You could like put level five gore. So when you actually shot somebody and killed them, more gore came out than consisted that
in
consist
the body,
of a
yeah.
body,
yeah.
right?
It was
like
awesome,
three
though.
Bodies worth of gore, and it was awesome.
Five stars.
I remember that.
I totally believe those results, but for completely anecdotal reason, in that that exact kind of frustration is like the only thing that will like make me feel aggressive.
Yeah.
You know, it's like when you something doesn't work the way it's supposed to work, like I'm doing something and it's supposed to have an effect and it's not having the effect that it's supposed to have is really
it's very
frustrating. Yeah.
It's time for science or fiction.
Evan, do science or fiction. Hit us. Make it quick.
Do it.
All right, I'll make it quick. Here we go. So, okay, so this is going to play off of what our listeners at home heard as last week's science or fiction, but for you today in the audience, you heard it earlier today when we recorded our show, in which science or fiction, the theme was New York City. So, because this is the New England, this is the Northeast Conference for Science and Skepticism, today's theme is Boston.
Boston.
And there are four choices. Four. Just like Steve did. See how that works? Here we go. Boston. Number one. The first European settlers of Boston called the region Tribus Faba, which translates as three beans. Number two. It's against the law to refer to any part of the day as happy hour. Number three. The Fig Newton is named after the Boston suburb of Newton. Number four. The Boston Red Sox baseball team has patented the color known as Fenway Green. George, you're our guest. You get to go first.
Okay. I would say that the fiction is that the fact that Boston was called Three Beans, there's no way. There's no way. Happy hour, yes. Fig Newton, fine. Boston Red Sox, Fenway Green, sure. Totally buy it. I would say the Three Beans is fake.
I'm going to say that happy hour is against the law is fake.
I'm going to say that you can't patent a color, therefore Fenway Green is the fake.
Oh, this is great.
Ooh.
Loving this. And we have Bob.
It's great. Bob just ran out of gas. It's perfect.
And Bob, if you don't answer quick, you're going to be...
You trying to motivate me there?
Really?
Fig Newton, that was on Big Bang Theory. They actually talked about the Fig Newton on the Big Bang Theory. I'm just trying to remember.
Bob, just pick one. All right, pick the Fig Newton one.
Go with your gut. No, but I don't remember.
Well, I'll be different then, so far.
Tribus Faba.
Go with your gut.
All right, I'm gonna GWG. I'm gonna go with Tribus Faba, fiction.
Yeah, no,
you sounded so confident.
See, boom.
This is good. I thought I knew all the Boston facts, so these are very good, Evan. I've never heard the Three Beans thing, but I do believe it. I'm trying to remember how many bars I've been to that might have had happy hour. I think that one's actually true because of the blue laws in Boston are really severe. You can't sell alcohol on Sunday. The whole deal. Puritans. Fig Newton, named after the Boston suburb of Newton, I've also never heard. But that one, I thought that it was related to Isaac Newton. But I don't know why I always thought that.
I thought it was Juice Newton.
Oh, wow. Obscure.
What is that?
Yeah.
Wow. Oh, good.
Thank you.
Playing with the Queen of Hearts.
No one else. Oh, thank you. Thank you.
And Steve's thing about patenting. I... now I'm trying to think if it's actually a trademark, but yeah, because you can't, like, Tiffany blue, you know, there's tons of colors that
this
are
heavy for you.
Trademarked. Thank you.
So which one did you
pick? So I don't, I'm going to go with the...
Turned it off.
I'll go with the trade... The no, I'm going to go with Fig Newton. Why not?
Okay.
All, right. All over the place.
So we did this a little bit different in
spread
that...
Out.
We'll pull the audience after the drinking skeptically.
I don't know what happened to my computer.
Yeah, Evan, pull, well, let's pull the audience.
Yeah, pull the audience. So for those of you who think that the early settlers of Boston was named first named Three Beans, clap, applaud.
If you think that's the fiction.
If you think that's the fiction.
That's the fiction.
Evan's new at this.
I'm trying to get my computer to work. If you think that, what was the second
the one? Patent of the color.
Well, that was the fourth one.
Second one's the Newton.
Happy hour.
So if you think it's illegal to refer to it as happy hour in Boston, applaud if you think it's the fiction.
Okay.
My homies. Third one, if you think the Fig Newton one is fiction, named after Newton, Massachusetts, applaud if it's fiction. Okay, a few. And the last one in regards to Fenway Green, if you think that it is fiction, that you can't patent a color, applaud. That's a pretty decent spread. Well, I do remember what the answer is, but
I heard that FedEx patented their brown color, right? Yeah, so you can patent a color.
FedEx isn't brown. UPS is brown.
UPS, sorry, whatever.
Whatever.
It's obviously working for them.
I'll leave it up to the audience. I'll leave it up to the audience. Which one do you want to hear first? In order? You got it. The first European settlers of Boston called the region Tribus Faba, which translates into three beans, is the fiction.
Oh!
Yo!
Plunk.
Nice.
Here we go. Actually, it was the first early settlers of Boston. They called it Tri-Mountain, which is three mountains. Three mountains of Boston?
There are no mountains
which
in Boston.
Which means wicked.
There are no mountains in Boston. Okay. was given the name by the 1630 settlers to the peninsula that would later be incorporated in as the city of Boston. The name was derived from a set of three prominent hills on the peninsula, two of which were leveled as the city was modernized. The middle one, Beacon Hill, shortened between 1807 and 1824, remains to this day as a prominent feature of Boston cityscape. Tremont Street still carries an alternate form of the original name. The two smaller peaks were Cotton Hill and Mount Whoredom.
Whoredom?
Whoredom. Thank you. And there you have it.
I wasn't correcting. I was asking. I was picturing a land of prostitutes.
Whoredom?
Whoredom.
Yeah.
Whoredom.
And all of Whoredom.
Right.
Welcome to Whoredom.
You are the queen of Whoredom.
The second one was it's against the law to refer to any part of the day as happy hour. That one is science, or it is true. Former Governor Michael Dukakis signed the ban on happy hours in 1984. He signed it as part of a broader effort to crack down on drunken driving. Happy hour is banned in many other states as well. Massachusetts was one of the first to do so. The state banned the promotional drinking periods in 84 after a woman was killed by a drunk driver who had seven drinks at a happy hour event. So there you go.
How many more people must die?
Exactly.
Was it a pinball event?
Might have been. Third one, Fig Newton is named after the Boston suburb of Newton. That one is correct. A Philadelphia baker and fig lover, Charles Roser, in 1891.
You fig lover. You're a fig lover. Don't deny it.
God hates figs.
God hates figs. Very good. I will banish you to whoredom.
He invented and then patented the machine which inserted fig paste into a thick pastry dough.
What? Show us that again.
Is that the international sign for fig paste?
Fig paste into the pastry.
And Sheldon Cooper did correctly point out that it was invented in Newton.
He did. Okay, good.
Did.
So,
and
you
it
had
was
a,
Penny
you had a hand
who
up.
Thought it was
so you knew that one.
Oh, okay.
You knew that one. Yeah. But I got you on the Fenway Green, right? Because, yes, that is, in fact, patented, and it is also trademarked.
Okay.
It is patented and trademarked.
It's both.
What's patented?
The color itself. You are not allowed. You have nobody has permission to use that color except for the Boston Red Sox. They are the discrete owners
in
of the
United
patent.
States.
Anywhere. Yeah, with U.S.
But how does
patent.
That apply to a patent? How does a patent apply to a color? Do they patent the chemical process of making that color?
You lost, Steve.
I'm objecting to the word patent because that was the basis of my thinking it was fiction. So I'm going to independently investigate that.
Okay, that's fine.
Hey, otherwise I'm at 0% this year.
Okay, we'll get back to you.
Suck it up, Steve.
To be continued on that one.
But good fig lover.
Good job, Evan.
Good nice job, guys. Thank you.
Good job, Evan.
You fig lover.
See, Rebecca, that wasn't too bad.
All right, thank you, Evan. That was great. So, Jay, close us out with a quote.
I would love to. This is a quote from William Harwood. The difference between faith and insanity is that faith is the ability to hold firmly to a conclusion that is incompatible with the evidence, whereas insanity is the ability to hold firmly to a conclusion that is incompatible with the evidence. This is a quote from William Harwood.
Yeah.
There's those lungs.
So I would take questions, but Rebecca has shit to do.
Yeah.
Yeah, blame me. Yeah.
We got you some ads.
Hey, everyone. This is Steve, Bob, Jay, and Evan breaking in at the end of our private recording. That was a lot of fun recording that show. We always love doing those.
Oh, yeah. They're the best.
Couldn't stop laughing.
Before we go out, we do have to, Evan, make a little correction. I promised you I was going to independently research whole trademark patent situation.
Yep.
And I found out a couple of interesting things. You can trademark a color. In fact, there's court precedence for that, legal precedence. What's interesting is you could only patent a color if it's used exclusively to identify the brand or the source of something.
For example?
Like the company that makes insulation patented the specific color pink of their insulation. Mm-hmm. So pink is not functional in any way to the value or the function of the insulation. It's purely a branding color. However, there was another suit where a shoe company tried to trademark the particular shade of red for their shoes. And the judge ruled that, you know, the company was using the color red to enhance the product, to make it more sexy. Cause that's, that's a functional use. And that's therefore would give them an unfair advantage against their competition. So you can't like hoard a useful color for yourself by trademarking it. But if the color serves only the function of recognizing your brand, then it's okay.
Plus, I'm sure it helps that, this, you know, how many types of insulation are there compared to how many types of shoes are there? That seems like that would factor in a little bit.
I don't know. It was purely on the issue of functionality from what I read. So Fenway Green, which has nothing to do with the function of the ballpark or the wall or anything, is indeed trademarked. That precise shade of green can only be used by, and it's exclusively made for the Red Sox. It can only be used for Fenway Park. However, it's not patented.
Mm.
It has a service mark. Now, if you look up, this is, I think, where the confusion came in. United States Patent and Trademark Office. So it's the Patent and Trademark Office, but they've issued a service mark for Fenway Green. It doesn't have a patent registration, doesn't have a patent number. I cannot find any evidence that it's ever been patented or that I also could not find that you can patent a color. I don't think that you can.
Yeah, I took a little further look into that as well, Steve, and I came up with the same. I could not find the actual patent itself. I found plenty of references online saying that it was patented, but they all seem to be making a mistake here.
Yeah, I think it's just because it's the Patent and Trademark Office, or they're just interchanging those two words without being precise in their meaning. But it's interesting. But, you know, again, that, you know, I know I'm being defensive here, but that was the very basis at which I said for rejecting that item was that I don't think you could patent a color. And I think that that bears out.
Sure enough. So therefore, officially, Steve, we're going to call you, your guess is not being incorrect.
Yeah. So the way we've done this in the past is when one of the ones that I thought was a science turns out to be a fiction, then those are just both correct. The real fiction and the stealthy fiction are both considered correct answers.
That seems fair.
I think so. I think that's within the inside the fair pole. So you're good.
Yeah.
That's a baseball reference.
All right, guys. So, hey, let's close out our private recording.
Get out of
Slam.
Here.
Slam.
That's good work, Steve.
Get off my lawn.
So thank you all for joining me this week.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
This was fun.
George, thank you for joining me.
Always a pleasure.
We'll hear you again on Geologic Podcast.
Anytime.
And thank you again to our studio audience.
Yeah.
You guys are great.
Awesome. Big lovers. Every one of you.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible.